It's September 24th, 2023, and welcome to episode 269 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and once again, trying to remember how to podcast. I'm Paul Hagstrom near Boston. I am joined by two retro computing enthusiasts this time. Quinn, updater of things from, what is it, southwestern Canada?
Rural British Columbia is what we're going with, because okay. There's nothing anywhere close to me that's a landmark, so that's all I can say is
all right.
BC, middle of nowhere in BC.
All right. And making a triumphant return from Toronto, Carrington
Hello.
Welcome.
I return triumphant.
Yes. Not much Woo-hoo. More stuff in the background, but it's all right. Record player and a couch and a chair. That's what we need.
Yeah. And one of those has to go.
That's right.
We are genuinely excited to have you back, Choose Carrington. Two. It's been a very long time.
Woo. I didn't even know you guys were still podcasting.
Yeah. Yeah, podcasting we're talking about is still a thing.
Yeah. But yeah. My feed hasn't been updated.
Yeah.
I'm subscribed to RCR, surprise, and have been since the early days, surprise. I get no new shows, man. You guys have cut me off somehow.
I believe that for most people it worked. I don't know why for you it didn't. But there's, so let me, I'll put here's the page, the Retro Computing Roundtable page. And on it, you can see that 266 is the most recent one. It was posted in middle August. Very long
hold
time
up
ago.
For the camera on my phone, which shows yeah. I'm on 262, baby.
Right. So what we did partly when we switched over to the new site is I separated the feeds out. So there's an archive feed and a current feed. And the archive feed basically goes up to where the switchover was. The point being, I don't know what the point was. I think it was because I couldn't get the UIDs right. Like, it was not going to be possible to actually get the correct, whatever they are, unique identifiers for each episode, because our feed only had the last 10 or something like that. So I just decided, all right, well, we'll just start over. And so 1 to 262 is in an archive feed, which actually maybe you can't see it here, but there is a separate RSS for that. And so that at least lines up with the number that you last have.
It's suspiciously similar.
Yeah. The actual feed, so I think maybe what, so you said that your feed is hosted at Apple, right?
Yeah, it looks like that's how I subscribe. It's hard to tell. Apple Podcasts really wants to hide info from you. What a shocker. It's very hard to know what you're actually subscribed to in that app. As far as I can tell, I'm subscribed to some RSS feed that's going through Apple. That wouldn't really be the one, but that I go to, and then Apple is shunting me off as a pointer to something else. So.
Yeah, and I think it must be shunting you off to the podcast archive. And So it's supposed to be, if you look in the sort of catalog, there should be two Retro Computing Roundtable entries, one that has a big green archive sticker on it, and one that has the current one. And it looks like, if your feed is actually rcrpodcast.com/feed/podcast, that is the live one. And I did try to, update the iTunes, and maybe I just failed. I don't know. I sort of like restarted
it. I've done it, but I've moved feeds a bunch. Recently, Doubletake and Eden My Group both moved hosts pretty seamlessly. So normally you just do a 302 or whatever redirect from the old RSS to the new one, and the new one has to have that tag that says I am a new one based on the old thing, and then everything should just work itself out. But if you don't have access to the old RSS feed, like Cyberears is down, then you can't post a 302 over there. So
right.
Yeah, we can.
Yeah. And I think basically I think anyone who had subscribed to the RCR.com, RCRpodcast.com feed, like if that's the address, everybody made it. I think we had like one duplicated episode or something. It wasn't bad,
But it was worth listening to twice. I think I was on that one.
Yeah.
Might not be a bad idea to throw a 20-second episode that says, hey, if you're getting this and you think you're not on an archive feed, you're wrong. Go resubscribe.
Yeah. That is probably what we'll do. Good idea.
Just use that audio. Anyway. There you go. That was all gold.
That's why they call him One Kit Carrington.
Yeah. That's why they call me that. That's the only reason.
Oh, no.
Nothing to do with my shoplifting history.
Never give a man opening.
Never. All right. So, welcome to our...
welcome to this.
Not very often updated
feed. You're still
feed
subscribed
anyway.
To this.
Yep. They've been coming actually fairly rarely. So I have gotten some, messages in the feedback that say, I think your feed's broken. Some of those might be actually because the feed's broken because they're looking at the wrong one. And some of those
might
just be
critical of the way we podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're getting what you pay for, people.
No, what are you posting? Just the outtakes? What is this? I discovered recently that I was fairly into Twin Peaks back when it was on and airing, and that was like when I was in college, and so we'd all watch the next episode and try to figure out what was supposed to be happening, and then the next one would come on, and then there was a movie, Fire Walk With Me, and when they made that movie, I think it was something like 4 hours long, and so they cut out something like an hour and a half in order to make it theater friendly, and just a few years ago they actually released like the other parts, like all the parts that they cut out of the original movie. It was released as like the missing pieces or something like that. And I only discovered that like 2 days ago and never did watch it. So I feel like a bad Twin Peaks fan for not even knowing that happened. But anyway, that's what I was thinking, is that maybe what people think they're getting are all the stuff we left on the cutting room floor. But in fact, this is it.
This is a safe space. You can share your lesser Twin Peaks fandom here.
Sorry. We're not judging any more than normal.
Yep.
take that for what you will.
So, we haven't recorded very often recently. We're hoping to get back on track, but we're moving very slowly through the 60s in our sort of correlated years with episode numbers. We are we're on episode 269 because 268 was the Kansas Fest mega podcast thing. So we're going to combine 1968 and 1969 here, I think. And so I just made a little list of things that were in 1968, and we can talk about them or anything else you may have found. Maybe we can actually start with the go-to is considered harmful publication.
I got things to say.
Yeah, so Edgar Dijkstra published in the Communications of the ACM an article basically that said it was trying to suggest that you shouldn't be using GoTo. Mm. So Carrington has things to say.
So math people and computer people will know Dijkstra because of Dijkstra's algorithm. It's that guy. It's that Dijkstra, which is a shortest path algorithm. So you want to get from place to another place or do games or whatever. That's one of the algorithms. Quinn will know.
Yeah, it's the precursor to A*, which is kind of the standard pathfinding algorithm. People might know that.
I am hearing it for the first time. That's cool.
So we start with this guy, right? Okay, mathematician. But the point is, like, famous for doing a whole bunch of things, but kind of, made his name as like the a short path guy. It's all about, I'm trying to find through math. How do I get there quickly? So that's the person that's writing this, and so you can imagine why somebody who's making his life's work short path stuff, he's going to be philosophically against go-tos. Like he's going to say, no. So this article, two or three pages, a couple of columns, it's not a ton of stuff, but he's going on a bit of a rant here about why you shouldn't use go-to. He's making the case that it's bad to do that. Don't jump to other places. And I remember as a kid, I would hear this all the time. It was just like a thing people would say, shouldn't use GoTo, shouldn't use GoSub. Not even just the specific terms, like it doesn't have to be a basic thing, but the concept of you're looking at the code and it leaps to someplace else. The idea that somehow is a bad thing or could even possibly be avoided in any program is kind of crazy, but he's making the case here that we shouldn't do that. I looked up on his Wikipedia article because I read this and I got the impression, I'm like, this is comedy. This isn't meant to be funny. And the more I read, the more I was convinced of that. I thought, well, am I right? Is this that Dykstra? It is. And I looked on his Wikipedia thing, and it's just like Dykstra was known for his vocal criticism and absence of social skills and outspoken critical visionary. He was strongly opposed to teaching a BASIC. I'm like, okay, he hated BASIC, didn't like GoTo. I guess he is just like a big old grumpy Gus. But when I read this article, I think – it's comedy. Like, it's got this, it can't be that unaware of what he's doing, because what he's arguing is that it's bad to, like, an illogical argument is the argument he's making here. When you look at the code, you're going line one, line two, one, line three, line four. It is bad. It's always bad to leap some other place, to break the flow. We shouldn't do that. But as the article goes on, he does that more and more and more in his own writing. So if you look at, I'm gonna pick a line here from like whatever. Okay, here's something from like the third paragraph. For that reason, he's making the argument why you should not in any case break the flow of what you're saying. Just always don't break the flow. He says for that reason we should do parentheses as why programmers are aware of our limitations close parentheses our utmost to shorten the conceptual gap between the static program and the dynamic process to make the correspondence between the program parentheses spread out text space close parentheses and the process parentheses spread out in time parentheses as trivial as possible. I'm like, you just broke your own four times in the same sentence. There's no way you're not doing that on purpose. And as it goes on, he keeps doing like more and more. When you look to the bottom of the first column, it's like this, when we include conditional clauses, and it's like parentheses and another parentheses. And then after introduced, like choice clauses introduced by CAR horse, open parentheses, case, bracket, I, bracket of, embedded parentheses, A1, A2, dot, 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 close, AN, close parentheses, close second parentheses, close comma, because we're in a parenthetical clause. I'm like, there's no way you put all that into one paragraph when you're trying to argue that you should in no way divert people. So I read this. I just found it funnier and funnier and funnier until I get the very last paragraph, which is into, oh, by the way, in the way you should never jump elsewhere, the guy uses multiple instances of footnotes, which are literally go-subs, but whatever. Like, it's so Casio. What are you doing, dude? Use inline references if you're so opposed to going elsewhere. But he says in Giuseppe Giacopini seems to have proved the logical, in parentheses, superfluousness of the go-to statement. So this other person, who I haven't mentioned before, has proven what I'm saying. The exercise to translate an arbitrary flow diagram more or less mechanically into a jumpless one, however, is not to be recommended. Like, don't do what I've argued this entire article. And his last paragraph, or his last sentence is, then the resulting flow diagram cannot be expected to be more transparent than the original one. His last sentence is, everything I just said was wrong. The idea that this wasn't done on purpose seems farcical to me, but apparently he just, in real life, had no social skills and was actually against GoTo. But if I tried to write a comedy article, which is like a thing I get paid to do for a living, if I tried to write this as a satire, I would present this to my editor and go, people are going to find this hilarious. I nearly fell off my chair. I think this is comedy gold, and he secretly loved to make fun of people. His whole, and no one's noticed till now because he was so subtle. He's got to be. This has got to be comedy.
Well, that's a hot take. I'll give you that. Honestly, like I think this is just a case of when
I think it's just how he
writes. Well, it's written in that very heavy academic style. And if you read a lot of papers and you write a lot of papers, they're all written like this. And I think you just get so embedded in that world that this reads normally to you. It doesn't read the way that, you know, it does to someone who doesn't read a lot of academic papers. That's kind of what I'm thinking.
But I found this very funny. The more I read it, the more I found this hilarious. Yeah.
I mean, your interpretation of it is a good commentary on the academic writing style and how it is sort of a self-satire at this point. I mean, it gets so dense with the sub-parentheses and the footnotes that it does at some point become a satire of itself in trying to obscure clarity with technical structure in the composition, which, you know, there's a lot of structure for the sake of structure in academic writing, I think. I don't know, Paul probably has thoughts on that. Given what you do.
Well, I, I didn't notice the like the parenthetical remarks and stuff. Although, yeah, I can see what you mean. There was actually something. Well, okay. So first of all, he starts off with the sentence: "For a number of years, I've been familiar with the observation that the quality of programmers is a decreasing function of the density of go-to statements in the programs they produce." It does seem like, you know, he's leading off with already something that seems somewhat comical.
Yeah, he's certainly being pithy, if nothing else. Like, it's definitely a little tongue-in-cheek in places.
So, I read the article, and it made me laugh.
Yeah, and where was that? Oh, yeah. Yeah, here it is. He's busy. He's talking about something. You know, it's sufficient to point in the program text to a point between two successive action descriptions. And then he goes on to say, you know, this could either be successive action descriptions or successive action descriptions.
Which is itself embedded in a larger parenthetical clause surrounding all of those.
Yeah. It would be interesting to be able to go back in time. I mean, this was written in 68, so it would be interesting to know, you know, in the context of the time where academia was, where computer science was, this may have read more or less like comedy than it does to us now, 60 years later. Mm. So it's sort of hard to judge cultural content in something from that long ago, too.
Yeah.
But also to even make, to start off with the argument that programmers shouldn't branch. It's like, yeah, good luck with that. That's going to be great. I look forward to seeing your program.
Well, and more, he comes out of the gate swinging, like, if you branch a lot, you're stupid. Like, you're a bad programmer who is stupid if you branch. Like, that's, he's...
Have you seen how any part of a chip works? Like, what part of a computer do you think doesn't have branches? What, come on, man.
Well, I think he does say at the end that essentially, if you're doing anything other than, like, machine coding...
Which branches.
Yeah. Branches. Somewhere there is a thing that says, I don't know where it is, but yeah, I mean, he does sort of accept direct machine language coding.
And to that end, I mean, my interpretation of the closing paragraph is more that he's acknowledging that branching is unavoidable. He's just sort of postulating a perfect world where it wasn't necessary. Like, one can imagine mathematically that some abstract programming language exists where branching is unnecessary at, because he keeps referencing people who've proven that mathematically you can solve these problems without branching in principle. So there should be a world that we could work towards that looks like that or something. Something kind of in that kind of vein, I think, is what I feel like he's trying to say. But yeah. I don't know. Who knows?
Well, and I guess I sort of interpreted this as being not so much that you can't branch, but that you shouldn't exit a loop in the middle and that kind of thing. I mean,
right?
You know, it's kind of the break statement.
Yeah, he's distinguishing between looping and branching for sure. Like, looping is fine. It's just more unconditional breaking out of things and that sort of thing. Yeah, unconditional jumping around
and getting up and getting down.
jumping around.
So that's what jumped out at me for 1968. Unintentional comedy. What do you guys have for 68 and 69? Anything leap out computer-wise?
Yeah, so the Computer History Museum has a nice little list of, like, things that happened in year what? And, you know, 1968, first thing was the go-to letter. 2001, Apollo Guidance Computer makes its debut. We talked about that, I think, before. CICS is released. I don't know how meaningful that is to anyone else, but my mother used to talk about it a lot because she used to work on IBM mainframes. There was something that I wanted to... Here we go. Shrewdloo. Do people know Shrewdloo? Probably.
No.
Probably everybody knows Shrewdloo.
Never heard of it.
No, I don't.
Cool. Oh. Cool acronym.
Yeah, it is. Terry Winograd did a PhD thesis at MIT, basically working on artificial intelligence. And what Shrewdloo is basically... It's a little bit... It's in the same kind of universe as ELIZA. But so it knows a very small domain of... things. It knows a little block world, and you can ask it to do things in the block world. So that's it's different from ELIZA in that it actually is representing this knowledge in some way.
Okay, I think I may have heard of this actually at some point. Okay, go on.
The dissertation was 1971, but the work was earlier. Because I remember noticing that the advisor was Seymour Papert, you know, the logo guy. But anyway, Shrewdloo. Here's a little video. I can show a little video of it running. So there's a little blocks world, and you can type things to it, like put the big block on the little block or something like that. Put the triangle, put the blue pyramid on the red block, and then it animates a little arm that picks up the block and puts it where you said. And it's got a whole planning thing. So if the thing you're trying to put it on is underneath something else, it will take the other thing off first and then put the thing, and it only has one arm, so it has to put stuff down and pick stuff up. It's fairly sophisticated, but it only knows this like little block world.
Yeah. The natural language processing, which I guess is sort of the point of this, seems to be very good. Like based on this demo that we're watching, he's typing full sentences, certainly better than any Infocom parser. It's interpreting, and he can ask it questions like, what is under the blue triangle? And it'll say the red cube or whatever. So that's pretty cool. Mm.
It'll also, to a certain degree, understand, like if you use a pronoun later, it'll remember what you were most recently talking about so that it could figure out what you're saying. Because these problems are hard,
yeah.
It turns out. Well,
and it has some grasp of the world. Like it just asked it to stack two pyramids. And he's like, I can't do that because they're pyramids. So that was also quite cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. This was 1971, you said?
That's when the dissertation was.
Okay.
Its first release was 1968.
Okay, gotcha. Wow, for 68, this is really actually kind of amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Do we know what hardware this is running on?
I don't.
Because the graphics, I guess it's like wireframe. It's like a little wireframe 3D world. So there's like a wireframe box room, and inside that room are like wireframe boxes and triangles and cones and things. And then there's a text display or text line at the top of that. So it's fairly impressive graphically for the period, not to mention how good the text processing is.
And it's a little bit ridiculous that it actually animates the little hand going down and picking up the block and moving
it. Yeah, there's like a little
that's
crane.
Probably
like,
unnecessary.
Yeah, there's like a little crane that comes down from above and picks things up. It's neat.
So it looks like this ran on a PDP-6.
Oh, wow. What would the display have been?
A deck graphics terminal.
Oh, okay.
A microplaner, and the thing was made in Lisp.
Wow, interesting.
From what I'm reading here.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know they had graphical displays like that at the N68. In 68, I would have guessed like the display would be an oscilloscope. You know, that's kind of that era of graphics when they were doing everything on oscilloscopes. Huh.
Although, the mother of all demos was also that year, so.
Okay.
That has
yeah, but
more.
That was really from the future.
Yeah. Right.
Was really
yeah. Well,
alien,
that was largely like theoretical. Like he had some working stuff, but it wasn't like he had a working laptop, even though he described what laptops were going to look like. Yeah.
Yeah. Put the littlest pyramid on a block. And then it did it. And then the person asked, how did you do it? And it answers. So, yeah. I mean, I'm sure this is a well-crafted demo.
Yeah.
You know, that hits all the impressive things without showing off the shortcomings, but still. And I think, so I don't know what Winograd's status is. It kind of looks like he's still around, and this information is on his page at Stanford.
I have a friend who was a PhD student at Stanford, so maybe she knows him. I will ask.
He's a guy who walks around with pyramids and blocks on his head.
Yeah,
I know that guy.
Yeah. I wonder if people troll him by asking him to stack pyramids everywhere he goes.
Right.
He's in the calf, and people just keep walking over and putting him on his tray. It's like, man, you do one demo in the 60s, and people just can't let it go.
Yeah. The name Shrewdloo is actually also kind of cool. It's it has to do with the word frequency of letters, but really what it has to do with is where they are on a linotype. The story is essentially, if you're typing on a linotype and you make a mistake, then you want to basically just highlight garbage there so that the editors will catch it and remove that line. And so people would just, they would just type junk. But the easiest way to type junk is just to like run your finger down the edge of the linotype keyboard. So the first column was ETAOIN. And Shrewdloo was the second.
So it's not an acronym for something?
No, it's just, it's a linotype, this is an error signifier.
It's like calling it a keyword.
Oh, okay, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. But the thing is that some of these would actually show up, so like not all the editors caught these errors, so you would just see like Shrewdloo in a line.
Like, published. Yeah, like the 60s version of a lorem ipsum when you look at a website and someone forgot to swap out one of the blocks of text in this template. Yeah. Huh.
Yeah.
He says that Mad Magazine used it as standard nonsense words, and that he read Mad Magazine. So there you go.
So somewhere it was hidden there in the depths of his memory. So I guess if you look at the line of Shrewdloo is there, the second column.
Oh, look at that. That's neat. Huh. I've never seen a line of type keyboard before. That's cool.
All right. It's possible we've milked that for as much as it's worth. But yeah, the other thing that was listed on that page was the mother of all demos. And we have talked about that before, so maybe we don't need to talk a whole lot about that now. But usually whenever we talk about it, I say I would like to try a Cording keyboard and then never actually do it. But they do still sell them.
And I always like to tell the story that they did find their niche in court reporting. Court reporter keyboards were corded keyboards. Apparently, I recently learned there's no standard in them, though. We talked about this, I think, here on the show, because there was that story a while back where someone reverse engineered the floppy disk from a court reporter keyboard to recover some evidence from a long ago trial. But apparently, there's like 8 different standards for those things, and they don't have their own. They don't have a standard data format or anything. It's just this terrible vertical where all of this crazy stuff proliferated. And yeah, it's kind of a neat story. But I assume everybody's seen this, right? Like we all got shown this in computer science or similar. Yeah.
Yeah, hopefully. Where is it? Somewhere. Well, okay, I guess I don't have it, but there are, you can find on YouTube a like remastered version of this. There's a, I don't know what, 5-10 years ago or something, there was posted a multi-part sort of cleaned up video of it. And it's impressive.
I mean, for anyone who doesn't know, this demo basically predicted everything that we now use essentially like 30 years later. So mice, Windows, hypertext, video conferencing, like source code revision, collaborative editing, like Google Docs, like just all of this stuff. He was all in this demo in 1968. Like this guy was just like, here's what the world's going to be like for the next 50 years. And he was basically right.
Yeah. Somewhere here, it says basically that, prior to this, let's see, let me search for crackpot.
It's a good word to search for in any Wikipedia page.
Crackpot. So prior to the demonstration, a significant portion of the computer science community thought Engelbert was a crackpot. When he was finished, he was described as dealing lightning with both hands.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah, the one part of his demo that didn't quite catch on was he envisioned the workstation as being like you're sitting in this like throne with a mouse in one hand and a corded keyboard in the other, so you never had to move any part of your body except your fingertips, and you could control the world, basically. That part didn't quite go, but certainly the mouse did, and a lot of the software stuff.
Yeah, and by now, you know, the watches and things are able to just notice if you just tap your fingers together without actually hitting any pieces of hardware.
Yeah.
So that would be pretty cool to be able to have a corded keyboard that's actually just virtual, so you just wiggle your fingers around. It's coming, I'm sure.
Yeah, there are like glove things that you can get that sense your finger motion so you can kind of type in the air. And then there's also computer vision things where you can like type on a laser projected keyboard that's projected onto your desktop, things like that. There's various things like that. They all lack feedback, of course, which is always the problem with such inventions.
We get feedback when you use them in like cafes or whatever. People are like, look at the dork. It's projecting. Yeah. Like, so that's also feedback.
Yeah. Wrong kind of feedback, but yeah, thanks.
It's the only kind I get.
It's force feedback when they punch you for being such a dork. take your lunch money. That's what we used to call haptics back in the day. Got your haptics right here, nerd. This is the quality content people sign into the wrong feed for.
Yep. So we closed off 1968-1969 pair of years with 1969, which, you know, had things like rope memory for the Apollo guidance computer and ARPANET comes online. So
never heard of it.
Yeah. I think this one, you know, so it says that in 1969, Thompson and Ritchie developed Unix. I think that is one of these things that's hard to pin to a year.
Yeah.
But apparently that is, in fact, what Ritchie says. He was born in 1969. And he wrote a little article to back that up. So it had a little bit of an impact.
And then 60 years later, Linux ruined it. Yeah, you heard me, nerds. Linux ruined Unix. Fight me. I don't get the RCR email feed, so whatever.
Yeah.
Say whatever I want.
Yep. Anyway, yeah. I mean, I don't think we need to dwell on that, but it's interesting anyway. You know, there was a PDP-7 in the corner. They were at Bell Labs. They were working with Multics, but then Bell Labs was kind of pulling out of support of Multics, and they wanted to have something that would run on this PDP-7, so they wrote that. And as a joke, the name was just sort of backformed from Multics to be Unix.
But, and then that trend continued, because every single tool in Unix is some sort of nerdy pun, which is sort of delightful. I mean, again, speaking of being predictive and timeless, you have to admire that the core structure of Unix is essentially unchanged and now essentially runs everything, you know, 60 years later, which is kind of amazing. I mean, your phone, your phone, your car, all of our servers, everything that isn't Windows, which is increasingly everything, is the same essential core, some version, some flavor of Unix that, would be recognizable to, you know, Ritchie in 69. So that is really something.
Okay. So I think we can probably leave 1968 and 1969 with that and move on to, what, 1976, I guess.
Right. Yes. Yeah. So I am going to draw people's attention to the OpenAC 1, which is sort of like an Apple 1 kit, but it takes a different approach. So the one I found online is only available, I think, now as a fully assembled version. You can't get the kit. There's no self-soldering. But unlike trying to make like an actual Apple One, this uses an actual 65 CO2 on a little circuit board with an Arduino Nano, and a PIC32, which, and now that the latter does the gives you a USB keyboard input and VGA output, the hard thing for old computers, and the Nano is interfacing to an SD card. And so, but essentially, you get this little kit, and it operates as if it's an Apple One, but it has BASIC in ROM, so unlike an Apple One, it's immediately usable when you turn it on, and you can do things. You can easily plug in a monitor, you can easily plug in a keyboard, and so it's like an Apple One kit that you can do more with if you want to kind of play around with Apple One stuff. And it's kind of sort of a neat approach. It's kind of like the old Retro Shield that came out for a while ago, but this one's like a bunch of little ICs you can kind of see laid out. So that's kind of neat. It's an open source project, so you can make it yourself. You can just go into GitHub and say, here's the stuff you need, or you can buy it for $130, fully assembled. So I think it's cool.
I got to say, the use of a PIC32 for USB and VGA is very clever. The Propeller microcontrollers were always kind of weird. They're a strange architecture, and they weren't ever quite as popular as the Atmels that are in the Arduino, but they had two secret superpowers, which was USB and VGA on the chip. And so to just sort of use that for those two superpowers is a great idea. I love that.
So it's neat. So basically, you have to supply the keyboard and the monitor, and this comes with everything else, and an SD card if you want to like write to things. And it's cool. You know, like if you want to play with old-fashioned BASIC, go ahead and get your BASIC built in, and go to town. It's neat. I like it. $130 looks fun.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I was wondering. So actually, if you look in the description, it talks a little bit about Tom Oad's book, Apple One Replica Creation. Where he kind of he's sort of talking about how you can build one of these things, like what the parts are of the Apple One, how it's like a terminal and a processor stuck together and that sort of thing, and so it looks kind of like this is built in the same way. Oh yes, okay. This was the thing I was going to say. It seems like it's leaning both on that and then on Vince Briel's Replica One as well. Mm. So I think it's sort of extending both of those. I moved off camera just briefly to grab my Replica One so I could hold it up in the shadow here.
Is the Replica One the one where it's like an actual trace for trace copy of the original? Is it?
No, okay. It's basically the same sort of strategy as the one we were looking at.
So like a modern work alike.
Yeah. Yeah. Gotcha. So I think it's also got a propeller chip on it. Okay. I have a CFFA1 on it, which is, you know, the Apple One version of the CFFA card. So it's kind of blocking the view, but
it's
cool.
Did Vince also do, cause I thought it was him that did, there was also a perfect trace for trace copy of the Apple One kit that you could buy, but it was like you had to get all the old chips, which was a little difficult to do. But was that Vince Briel also, or was that somebody else?
No, I think Vince only did the Replica One, and there's been a couple of iterations. You can get the Replica One now at Reactive Micro, so like he's no longer doing it.
Oh, but, gotcha.
But they're selling them. So I think this is, it's kind of similar to the OpenAC one, but yeah. So the one thing, there are a few people who have made actual sort of board replicas, and Mike Willigal might be the one person you're thinking of.
That's who I'm thinking of. Yes. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. So yeah, he made, I've forgotten what he's called it now, but there was a name that he assigned it. And I don't know if he sells those anymore, but there were a few. There was a Newton. The one I have one that went by the name Newton One, which it's, you know, right now it's just a big, this fairly big green board with nothing on it, you know, because I have about 78% of the parts, and the parts I'm missing are the difficult to find ones.
Yeah, that's what I remember about Mike Legal's kit is that some of the parts were hard to get because you have to not just get like TTL chips, but you have to get like the old slow ones too. Like, you can't use the HCs or the, you know, the LS, you know, architectures of TTL. You have to use the older ones, which some of those are hard to get. It's funny what a popular target the Apple One is for recreation, considering how few people would have ever seen one or used one and how little it actually does.
you can
plug it in and write some integer basic, maybe save that to cassette, and then that's it. You're done. But
though, I mean, so this one has an SD card, and you can get a CFFA1. The CFFA1 will work on your actual Apple One if you have an actual Apple
that's
One.
That's cool. How does it do it? Like, because the Apple One didn't have any kind of disk drive support, so does it act as a cassette drive, or?
I'm not sure actually how it functions. I mean, I'm sure it's got some sort of. It probably works kind of like the Apple II with a little firmware area. Because the Apple One had an slot, I think, that you could put the cassette card in. So.
Oh, yeah, that's right. The cassette port was like an option or something. Yeah. Okay, so maybe it works with cassette port ROM entry port points or something.
Well, even that wasn't built in, though. I mean, like, you had to get a card to get cassette output.
Okay, right, okay. So, neat.
But, yeah, I mean, it is true that there's not a lot you can do with these, including backspace.
Yeah.
Well, if you want a backspace, you have to type an underscore.
Apple users didn't get a backspace until, the 90s. So,
yeah. Right.
I was delighted when I got my Commodore 64 and the backspace just worked. I was like, oh, look at that. What a neat idea in 1984.
Yeah, Apple users all just write in pen.
Yeah, exactly. We're too hardcore. We just don't make mistakes. Take that, Commodore. Backspace is for the weak.
Okay. Anyway, cool kit. I think mine is next. And this is mine. So... it just recently, like a couple weeks ago, was announced that Wizardry has gotten a modern remake from from Digital Eclipse. So they're the people who we, I think, here recently talked about releasing the Acrotica documentary. It's possible that we never did talk about that. I think that may have shown up on the Mega podcast because we might have recorded before that. But there's a Digital Eclipse also released a Acrotica documentary that that contains Karateka and a couple of remakes, but also just contains sort of like documentary footage and development notes and things.
And that's available on Steam company. Now, if anyone's interested in that, the Karateka, it's like an interactive documentary making of kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting multimedia sort of package that it's all on Steam.
Comes with a pronunciation guide.
So that we already were sort of amazed by that, but then there was a recent announcement that Wizardry has now gotten treatment by the same company. It's not as much a documentary as it is just a game, and I think it's in kind of like early access mode now. Has anyone tried here?
I have not tried this yet. I have not. The shtick here for anyone who hasn't seen this is that it's a modern game built in the Unreal Engine. All the fancy graphics, looks beautiful. It's really, really nice looking game, but it's literally running the original Wizardry engine in an Apple II emulator inside this modern game. So,
which is kind of bonkers.
Yeah. Burger Becky on the Apple II Slack said that it's running the original Apple II code and that it's like looking at screen writes and requests for input and then patching into those to talk to Unreal and have it do all of the graphics and so on as needed.
And you can bring up the Apple II game as like an overlay.
Yeah.
Like a little wireframe overlay on your game and say, yep, here's what's happening behind the scenes. Yeah. It's like...
The idea that it's actually really like the logic is still written in Pascal, you know, or whatever.
Yeah, there was some debate about whether they, on the Slack, there was some debate about whether maybe they had patched into the P code since the game was written in Pascal. That would be a logical way to kind of get access to the code rather than running an actual Apple II emulator in there. But apparently that's not what they've done. If they are running a literal Apple II emulator, what I would very much like to know is what they're doing with the ROM, because that's one of the big things with Apple II emulators is that the ROM is still owned by Apple. They refuse to release the copyright on that. So if they are running an actual Apple II ROM in there, that might be interestingly problematic. I think, but there are minimalist ROMs, right, that you can buy or that you can download that are like public domain that don't have any actual Apple code in them. But
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they patch in all the like minimal ROM entry points that you need. They don't have like Apple soft or anything in it. But it's if you just want to write a game and sell it that runs in an emulator, it's just enough of the ROM to get the machine running. And has no Apple code in it. So that might be what they're doing. Or they might be using the Laser 128 ROM, which I think is available. And if it's not released to the public domain, I don't think VTech cares nearly as much as Apple does about that. So that would also be a good option, I think.
I believe at this point, this only runs on Windows.
Oh, boo.
So,
no.
And I got partway to trying... I think I bought it, and I got partway to trying it, but then didn't quite finish. But you know, what I wanted to do was try to run it in, Apple Silicon Windows, like ARM Windows, because I think that should be possible.
Their goal is just Windows and then Steam OS.
Yeah.
So it can go on a Steam Deck, but that's it.
Yeah. But it, you know, looks impressive. I'm very curious to try it.
The graphics are really something. Like it looks like a modern AAA game. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It really is. Like the artwork is fantastic,
and I do believe that, you know, as you're playing it, maybe they show it here, but you can bring the overlay up like over top of the crazy graphics. Yeah, there
it is.
So you can see both happening at once. It's funny because I never played Wizardry that much. I played it a little bit, but there was a certain element of tediousness to it, and I wonder how they get past that part.
They probably don't. I mean, those old RPGs were very grindy. You would spend hours just like trying to earn enough gold to buy the next sword or whatever.
Wizardry in particular, though, because there is no plot. There is just, there's a little store, go in, kill things, maybe you can come back to the store. Like, that's it. Like, that's the whole thing. That's why it never really gripped me. Like, Wizardry, I never got on the Wizardry train. I loved old RPGs, but I wanted a little bit of plot, or at least think, hey, there's multiple dungeons for me to go to or something. It's very bare bones.
Yeah.
I think its claim to fame was it was the first, whatever it's first of anything, party-based one, though. It's the first like RPG that was, hey, there's going to be six people in your party versus just you are a fighter, go kill things.
Yeah. Party-based, and I think it was the first also with that first-person view of the dungeon. Like, that was a big deal at the time, which was sort of then refined by things like Bard's Tale. But I think Wizardry was the first one to do that stepwise first-person view, which was, I guess, neat at the time. I was never into it either. Bard's Tale really gripped me, though. I mean, I loved all three of those games. I played played the heck out of them.
So you can bring up the overlay on this, but you can't turn everything into shades of green, which is a missed opportunity. Yeah, yeah. Just like go all green, high resolution, but just green, monochrome, baby.
So we did talk about something that was sort of similar a little while ago. That has the same kind of concept, which is this. I will remind us about Deathlord Relorded.
Deathlord Relorded, which I mean, maximum points just for the name. It tickles me every time I see it.
Yeah.
And I still never played Deathlord, although it looks really up my alley.
Yeah, I never played the original either. And this apparently is doing the same thing, writing the original Apple II code. The author of this posted in the Apple II Slack as well that that's what he's doing. And he said he's reading screen memory to know what to display with the modern graphics engine. So he sees, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I think what he said was that he's looking at what the Apple II is writing to video memory and then copying that. In the modern engine.
Waiting for Google Sheets to come out and say, behind the scenes, we're running VisiCalc.
Yeah.
We'll finally admit it. It's been VisiCalc all the way down.
So yeah, this Deathlord Reloaded is the first kind of modern remake I've seen do this technique of running the original code inside it. And I hope more people do this because it's neat. Like I love this idea of running the original code and then just hooking into the graphics and input. It's a cool idea.
It also has like a serious authenticity. It's like you can go to the places that you can. Like it really means you're adhering to early stuff. So I dig it.
Yeah. And it is really kind of a fun technical project too.
That quote on screen is hilarious. But
Auto-duel is why I scream at my family. Deathlord is why I cry in the shower.
Oh, auto duel. Oh, the hours I lost into that game. Oh my goodness. I would have gotten a lot better grades if that game had never been released.
All right. I guess that's enough of that. And Quinn, you have the next thing.
I do. I wanted to throw a little love at one of the machines I have a secret soft spot for, which is the PC Junior. This is...
Oh, God.
I know, but there's something about that machine that I just think...
Yeah, there's something about it already. Really? So you really have a soft spot for the PC Junior?
I do.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, I think because my best friend in junior high school had one. That is probably why. But, you know, you develop these weird emotional attachments to things when you're
sure.
young.
Sure. Oh, 100%. Yeah.
But I think it is a genuinely charming machine. Even with the terrible keyboard, although there was later a better keyboard that was released for it. But so my friend who I spent a lot of time at his house had one, and he had the original terrible Chiclet keyboard with the infrared that only worked when you were pointed directly at it, and all of that. But it had an excellent port of Jumpman, which, you know, is the game that Atari folks rave about. And that is an excellent game. And the PC Junior's port of Jumpman is surprisingly good. And it had that Tandy 3-voice sound in it, and it had the Tandy 16-color graphics in it. So it was actually a pretty decent machine for playing games on. It just never got any love software-wise. So anyway, this is an article about a PC Junior web server that has been running for 2,500 hours. And this is one of those, like, let's see if we can do it kind of retro stunts that I love. So it's a stock PC Junior with a NEC V20 co-CPU, which is some obscure PC Junior peripheral that I've never heard of, running at 4.7 megahertz. And then he's running an IDE sidecar, which is an IDE adapter for the PC Junior, with a 20 gigabyte IDE hard drive. Then he's running a Western Digital Ethernet card with a PC Junior to ISA bus adapter so that he can put an ISA Ethernet card in the PC Junior. And then running PC DOS 3.3. And that's basically it. And he served web pages on this thing for 2,500 hours. He ran it for 37 consecutive days, during which it processed 34,000 HTTP requests, which I think is kind of awesome. So it's one of those things where I'm sure as soon as the internet found out about it, it melted down from traffic, but it got loved to death, I'm sure. But he ran it just to see if he could, and, well, he did. So that's it. I just think it was neat. It reminds me of, like, the Christmas tree scene in that Chevy Chase movie where there's, like, 68 adapters plugged in to run his Christmas lights. It's that, but for a PC Junior. Like, the list of things that he had to chain together to make this happen is pretty awesome. But, yeah, it's a neat little stunt, I think.
That's pretty cool. I think there is I was looking around. I think that there's a site running on Alisa as well. I'm not sure if it still is, but it kind of reminds me a little bit of that.
Yeah, the challenge with these types of things is often getting the machine to serve the web page before the modern timeouts trip on the right. On the browser, right? Because modern browser timeouts are pretty tight because it's expected that your machines are going to be fast. So if it takes your machine 5 or 6 seconds to load all the HTML off of some floppy disk in order and then send it over the wire at, you know, 19.2 BPS or whatever, the browser is going to give up if all of that takes too long. So I think that's probably the trick. So they tend to keep the web pages very, very small. It's usually just like a handful of lines of HTML. Is what's actually being served because it just can't take too long or the timeouts are gonna trip. So
right.
They're not serving any video or any GIFs or anything on these websites.
No.
Or GIFs. No GIFs or GIFs.
Neither one.
No. No brands of peanut butter. Have you used a PC Junior, Carrington? I think you're being too hard on it. They are adorable.
That keyboard, man, I just saw it. I didn't like the industrial shape of it. And then I saw the keyboard that's going to like, okay, point this part at that part. I'm like, I'm out. Gone. Done. Out.
I think what I love about it is that it looks exactly like a family kid's computer designed by a room full of IBM suits. Like they took the PC 5150 or whatever, and like they made it a little rounder and they made it a little softer, and it's hilarious in that regard. Like it's exactly what a committee of marketing people in suits would have designed, but it manages to be fun, I think. Anyway, the keyboard is objectively terrible, of course, but It is kind of fun that because it's a chiclet keyboard, one of the reasons they did that was because it had these full keyboard paper overlay templates for using software. Because again, it was supposed to be super friendly. So if you're running WordStar on it, there would be a WordStar paper template, you know, like those things that used to go around the function keys on like WordPerfect. But this thing covered the entire keyboard, like an Intellivision game. And so it would have every single key had a little like description of what it did over top of it or whatever. So I think that was part of why they did that, because it gave physical space all the way around every key. But terrible.
but
it was sort of like...
But also, it came out in 84, I think.
Something
right?
like that, yeah.
So, like, I got hooked on the Mac. Yeah. Like, it came out, and I was like, whoa, that's the future. And just like everything else seemed, I abandoned Apple II. I abandoned everything for my little Macintosh.
Well, it got short shrift because mainstream PCs at that time were just garbage, right? You had like CGA graphics or, you know, Hercules or MDA graphics. And here was the PC Junior that had Tandy 16-color graphics and three-voice sound. PCs didn't even get sound till like the 90s, you know, not counting PC speaker. So, you know, throwing stones here from my Apple II glass house. But so it was actually a really powerful machine, graphics and sound-wise, when it came out. But everybody just dismissed it out of hand as being a worthless, terrible computer. So that was a bit of a sad thing. It didn't get a fair chance, I don't think.
The name probably didn't help the whole
Junior thing. Yeah, the naming was... probably turned people off. It made it sound like it wasn't good.
The Wii U of the 80s.
Yeah, I guess if you wanted to get like a small business to buy it, that might not be the name that you choose.
Yeah. Mm. Well, and the keyboard probably doomed it, honestly. The keyboard was so bad, that probably turned everybody off instantly. And they did. It was sort of like the original Xbox. Like they realized their mistake and immediately shipped a replacement keyboard that was better, like they did with the Xbox controllers. But it was too late. I think the damage was done.
I know that there was at least a rumor that you could, you know, carry your keyboard around and you know, type on other people's computers if you pointed
yes,
at them.
Yes, that was true. That was absolutely true. It was just like a TV remote. Like if you have a Panasonic remote, you can go around to any Panasonic TV and change the channel on it, which is good fun in airports, theoretically. The other problem PC Junior had was that it didn't have standard PC slots in it, which is a strange decision to make in a PC, right? Which is like its main thing is it's got a nice standard slot architecture. It used these sidecar things like the TIs and other things, which again, I think was supposed to be home friendly. Like you could just plug in these modules to add capabilities, but who's going to go and make these sidecar things when you can make a PC card that everyone else can use? So, you know, so yeah.
In the chat, Artenoy says they hobbled the Junior because they didn't want to hurt the sales of the PC. I think I heard that at the time as well. You always hear those things. It's like with Apple. We don't want to eat into something else. Always a bad move.
Yeah.
What are you thinking?
And you never know how true those rumors are. People always said that about the GS too, that they crippled it intentionally so it wouldn't compete with the Mac. Who knows if those things are true, but certainly certainly, it was too slow, the PC Junior, so that probably hurt it as well. For whatever reason, it is slow. Whether that was intentional or not, I don't know.
But it is cute.
Yes. It has a charm to it. There's something about it. Carrington's making a face like he just sucked on a lemon.
No charm. Nope, not for me.
All right, let's see. I guess so. That we have enough other stuff to talk about. I think that we can leave the items of interest and news there and move to a word from our sponsor.
Don't be lured by Commodore and TI's low-priced computer keyboards. You're not getting the whole picture. If you want a complete home computer system, the price will pile up fast. Introducing the Aquarius home computer system from Mattel Electronics, a complete system for a lot less. It comes with all this and an amazing feature no one else has, a 13-inch color TV for just $99. Buy the Aquarius system by June 20th. We'll send you a $300 color TV for $99.
When you want to play the hottest, fastest, most advanced fighting game ever, forget everything else and play Doom 2 on your PC. No other game gives you the incredible realism, the 360-degree smooth scrolling, and explosive action like Doom 2. It's easy to start playing, but it won't let you stop. Doom 2, it will consume you. Play solo against a computer, against a buddy by modem, or online in an awesome four-way deathmatch. Doom 2, playing in a PC software store near you.
Ordi Mini, c'est un ordinateur qui parle.
Bonjour, écrit Ravi.
Il corrige.
C'est faux. 8 heures.
Il félicite.
Super.
C'est gagné. Il apprend même la musique. Jonathan, des jeux intelligents.
And we're back. The host retro computing gift idea this time was picked because I was reading it. And it is John Romero's book, not super recent, but fairly recent, called Doom Guy, Life in First Person. I think it's kind of interesting. This is basically by the co-creator of Doom, with John Carmack, about basically the time leading up to the creation of Doom, and the part I'm at right now, you know, they just got to Quake, so I haven't actually finished it, but you can buy a hardcover of this book for 40 euros from John Romero himself. He will sign it and send it to you, and I think it's probably shipping from Ireland, but it's pretty good. It's I hadn't read a lot about the story of id, although I think it has been written about a fair amount. And one of the aspects of John Romero that he notes about himself is that he has you know, some sort of strange memory that allows him to kind of, that gives him a kind of perfect recall, you know, which also allowed him to really remember all these things that were happening. Seems reasonable. It all seems, told in remarkable detail, a byproduct of his hyperthymesia. Romero recounts his storied career. But
so you wouldn't really know whether you have that or you think.
Yeah, yeah.
I perfectly recall,
but
I keep telling you, you don't. You've never said that before.
Yeah. I guess you could maybe try to fact check things in some independent way. I guess you'd have to. But
I want to read his hair care guide because John Romero has the best hair.
Yeah,
in comp sci.
Yeah.
As a guy with none, I'm telling you, man, he has the best hair I've ever seen
about hair?
In comp sci. What do I know? Never trust a bald barber. The guy's, John Romero, famous hair. Good programmer, too, but really, come for the hair, stay for the
doom. At least all of the sort of interactions I'm aware of with him are pretty nice. I mean, like, you know, he's committed to, now at least he's sort of committed to, like, preserving Apple history and, you know, because he started on the Apple II.
He's been to Kansas Fest?
Yeah. Yeah, I've met him, you know, talked to him. Didn't really know who he was at the time. That's the embarrassing part. It's like, oh
really?
Everybody seemed very excited he was there.
I met him and he was super nice.
Yeah, he's a really good guy. Followed him on Twitter before that was a dumpster fire, and I've read a bunch of other stuff that he's written, and he seems like a really good guy. This would also be interesting to read just because it would be his take on the id story, because it has been written about a lot. Like, it was clearly a very dramatic time in video gaming, and that company was clearly a very dramatic place, a lot of money flying around and a lot of big personalities clashing. And so it's one of those situations where you get a very different story of what all happened there depending who you ask. And I don't know that his version of all of that has necessarily been told yet. So this would be that, I suppose.
Yeah. And he starts talking about working for Soft Disk, you know, writing things for Soft Disk and Commander Keen, and working with Apogee and Wolf 3D, Doom, Quake, you know. And so, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting view on just like how software development worked in that time when there really wasn't much to compare yourself with too. And, you know, getting network gameplay started, which is practically started by them, basically.
Yeah. Well, and Doom famously used broadcast packets, so it would essentially obliterate whatever network you ran it on, which was kind of hilarious at the time. It created a lot of havoc on a lot of corporate networks back in the day when we used to play it.
Which is like thematically appropriate for
Doom.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's, I'm not quite done reading it, but the part I've read is good enough that I can recommend it. You don't need to buy a hardcover autographed edition. It does exist in ebook form. But okay, so now I guess we can move on to eBay auctions. And Carrington, you have the first of these.
I do. Okay, so the first one, I picked a few things. This is really expensive. Apple II game for $130. Like, come on. But is it something I've seen, I think? Wings Out of Shadow. It's like an arcade game / novella by Fred Saberhagen, who I think of as the swords guy. He wrote all the swords books in the 80s, but also is the berserker guy. Like, all the army people in high school all loved Saberhagen's berserker books. And this is, I guess, a short story from Berserker World or something, turned into an Apple II only. Didn't come up for anything else for the Apple II, and I'd never heard of it before. So it's at least rare-ish. Probably comes up on eBay all the time. Maybe I just never noticed it, but I thought it was cool. So if you're a completionist for the Apple II, you now have to shell out another $130. Sucks to be you. Don't be a completionist. That's the lesson.
Yeah.
Don't know anything about this, except Fred Saberhagen apparently made an Apple II game, or was the writer. He wrote the dialogue in it or something, and then another company that I never heard of did the publishing and the rest of it. But kind of neat.
I've never heard of this. It looks like it comes with some sort of game board or map or something. Is that somehow involved in playing the game, I assume?
Yep. Some sort of strategy, like a shooter thingy. I don't know. I don't know anything about this. Moby Games has barely anything about it either. But it is a game.
Interesting.
It is an Apple II game in the form of a book by a writer.
It's got a fancy spiral-bound book thing. Yep. It looks kind of neat. I've never heard of this. I wonder if there's screenshots somewhere that a person could look at.
Hard to justify $130 for a game. Yeah. Like, you know, collectors will, but I'm like, oh my gosh, that's so much money for an Apple II game. Because this isn't a great Apple II game, or we'd all know
it. Yeah, it's probably not great. Yeah, the weird stuff was never great.
Yeah. Although, so anyway, that's my first choice.
If it turns out that you know, we don't know anything about it because this is like the only copy that still exists and no one.
Right. That should go for $2,000 or something. Anyways, buy it now for $130.
But we might want someone to get it and image it so that like.
Image it, not just to play it and go, ha ha ha. I know it.
Well, I just checked.
Now I'm motivated.
I just checked and it is in fact on Internet Archive already. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It has been captured. There's about a dozen versions of it and there's a 4 a.m. crack, of course.
Okay.
Of course. And that probably just happened during this conversation.
Yeah.
There's a, just in that connection, there is, I mean, I'll take over the screen for a second. There was a little series by Broderbund and Synapse, including Mind Wheel, which was kind of like this. It was basically a book that came with a little adventure game. I think there was a brief experiment of
some Star Trek ones as well.
Oh yeah,
that were similar to that. Those Star Trek games.
I don't know if
they did the same thing—a book and a game.
Yeah, I guess they did have some story aspects in them, but also just sort of manuals full of facts that you could use and that kind of thing. Mm. So there were a few of these attempts, and most of them.
That one on screen right now is $1,000. Holy moly!
Yeah, well, that's the seller, I think.
But I was complaining about 130. Yeah.
I would not recommend buying that one.
Just about to pull the trigger.
Yep. Yeah.
So speaking of expensive things, my second choice is Mission on Thunderhead, which I've always liked the box for it. This is a sealed version of it. This is not a super rare game. Comes up quite a bit. But if you like old Apple II games, these Avalon Hill things come around. I've always thought the cover on this is just fantastic and lovely. It makes me want to play the game. It's this version. There was also a cassette version of this for the Apple II. The reason I'm picking this one, see the box there is a little crushed, but it is a sealed version. But again, the Avalon Hill stuff sealed comes up quite a bit. But it's $49. These frequently come and it's $150, $180, $200. I'm like, come on, guys. This game. So it's nice to see one that is relatively reasonable. So $50, buy it now. For a not super collectible, but interesting old, like super old Apple II game. So it's by a person who wrote a different game that's very similar. I remember that came up first. I can't remember what it's called, but the guy who wrote this, if you look at the game, you're like, oh, you reused your engine and you made another game. Mm-hmm. So there's another game that's more collectible, which is the first game by this author. I don't remember the author or the game, but anyway, $49. Paul has seven copies.
No, I don't. I'm just scanning over the back to try to see. William Maxwell is the author, and I'm wondering if it from the creator of Maxwell Manor.
That's it. Maxwell Manor. Okay.
Okay.
So Maxwell Manor, same thing, came out, very similar game, also usually goes for $100. So it's just nice to see one of these games not go for like an insane amount or bidding begins at $200 or something. So if you've been holding out for one of these, you can finally get one for not $200. Yeah. And my third choice, I'm going to leave eBay and go back to Max Sold, which is kind of like a terrible place to buy stuff. It's a online garage sale, but it's local auctions. So unlike eBay, where you're going to buy something, it's going to ship to you. MaxSold, you go on to buy things that are in your city, and you're going to go pick them up, and it'll be like, okay, Sunday between 1 and 3 is to pick up for this auction, and whatever. And every once in a while, you can find bargains on there. Right now, in Brampton, Ontario, so if you're anywhere in Ontario, you can get yourself an iMac G4, no bids. So, and the way MaxSold works is, first bid is a dollar. If you bid $50, it goes in as a dollar. And you can... almost nothing sells on MaxSold. It's like items that sell for $500 and 99% of stuff doesn't sell at all. Things fly under the radar. So for the next 4 days, you can pick up a nice looking working iMac G4. It's the 1 gigahertz version, which just is a bit disappointing. But it's nice. 15-inch one, very clean, working, and you could almost certainly pick it up for a dollar. So if you've been holding out for one of those and you live in Ontario, you can go to MaxSold and hopefully be the only one listening who does that. Yeah. And you can get yourself an iMac G4.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're...
It's nice. Super clean version.
Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, this... So this is the iMac G4 is the one that, you know, looks like the Pixar lamp or whatever. It's a...
right.
It's very cute.
I love it. It's one of the few vintage computers I have is the 15-inch iMac G4, but I don't have this one. This is the later one, which unfortunately will only run OS 10. So I prefer and because it's okay, but a 1 gigahertz early model of the G4 isn't a super fast computer on OS X, to be honest. So, but it's a great computer for running Mac OS 9. So if you get this slightly, there's a version of this that's 800 megahertz from the year before, and it'll run OS, it'll boot natively to OS 9. And I think that's the way to run them. But if you want one of these and you just want to kind of play around with it, hard to beat a buck.
Yeah.
Those are my choices. Bye, bye, bye. Fill your life with things. It'll fill that empty hole in your life.
Yeah. I find that up always with works.
G4. Maybe, anyway. Gotta keep trying.
Yeah.
Gotta keep trying. That next thing will do it.
Okay, so I had found a million things, but I'll
That's one
I'll sort of sift through and pick them out. So here's one. You were sort of mentioning the sealed sealed Thunderhead. This one is a
I've been called worse.
So this is a sealed Wizardry Knight of Diamonds. So it ties into various things. The sealedness, the collectible
software.
So that's
software. What the second one?
This is a
Mad Overlord's the first one and the second?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so actually, if you were a follower of the Wizardry series, so the first one came in a box. It was a black, nice box with sort of green and red, almost sort of shiny printing on it. Really looked very good.
And a kind of weirdly small box, though. It's like the size of like a Blu-ray, but thicker.
Yeah, and actually it should be quite possible to find a picture of that.
There's always ones for sale.
But so the... Robert Woodhead was the speaker at Kansas Fest last time, and had like time before, and he had said basically that the box making this box was probably the thing that put it over the edge, because it really, you know, it made it seem like a real product. And I'm having a heck of a time finding like any example of that box as I scroll.
Really? You think you'd reach behind you and just hold yours up?
Oh, I should have done that. the series, they all came in boxes like this. So this one's Wizaprint. Here's the Proving Grounds one. And so like you could get them and line them up on your shelf. And I think they went to probably. I forget how far they went on the Apple. It might have only been to 4 before they left the Apple II platform.
Yeah, there are Wizardries that definitely are not Apple II.
Yeah,
at least the first 3 minimum were definitely on the Apple II.
Yeah, 4 or 2. I'm near certain. And so they were all in these boxes.
There's Wiz Plus.
Yeah, that one is a
which is the editor, cheating one.
Yeah.
It's funny that came in a box. Who knew?
So Wizardry 3.
Lots of software I was really familiar with that I never knew what the packaging looked like. For whatever reason.
Any reason could, who can say?
Yeah.
Could be anything. Maybe I just never looked.
But so one thing that's interesting about this, the Knight of Diamonds one, is that it was sort of conceived, I guess, initially as just an expansion pack or something. You know, so they originally released the box, you know, Wizardry 1 was in a box, and then Wizardry 2 was in this little folder. So this was the one that I was talking about. But
yeah, you can see it with the little hole on the top. You'd put it on a rack and just hang it.
And eventually they changed it, and they, you know, made a box for this too. So the folder is actually a fairly rare object. You know, it's a collector's item because Wizardry 2...
Which is funny, because normally the folder ones come later if there was a boxed one. If it wasn't just a folder thing. So it's neat that it says it runs in the Apple III as well.
Yep. Very good. But, and so this particular one is sealed. This is interesting both because it's rare and it's still sealed. And it's possibly not better because it's sealed, because
the sand is slowly shrinking. Yeah,
the shrink wrap has continued to shrink, whereas the contents have not.
Thanks.
So.
I didn't know that could happen.
Yeah. So
You see that in a lot of old software all the time. I see things shrinking down because the software, and if it's in a box, it just kind of rips the shrink wrap usually. But on these folders, they just start to curl.
I didn't know that, huh?
Yeah. So, you know, it's tempting to get a shrink wrap one because, you know, like you feel like that's going to be in the most pristine condition, but it might be all bent up.
Yeah. Huh.
So anyway.
Apple
I guess you know it's original shrink wrap then, because it's been in there a long time to have done that. Like yeah. in retro gaming, like in Nintendo and stuff, a common scam is people just buy shrink wrapping machines and reshrink because that turns out they aren't that hard to get. Right. So there's a whole school of people who know how to identify original Nintendo shrink wrapping, which has a slightly different seam pattern or whatever than modern desktop shrink wrapper that you can buy.
Yeah.
So according to the back of this. Mm-hmm. The graphics don't look nearly as nice as that version you just showed us on Steam.
Yeah,
I don't know what happened between 1 and 2, but wow. They must have lost their graphics.
Yeah, Unreal has really improved a lot since the 70s, apparently.
Anyway, so right now, this is at a current bid of $28. It has...
But it's a new listing.
Yeah, it has 8 days to go. I expect it's going to go for a lot, but...
Yeah,
there were, you know. In fact, actually, I think there were two versions of this folder because I'm pretty sure there was an early one and a later one. I tried to ask Robert Woodhead about this, and he didn't really remember. You know, I mean,
he's no John Romero,
right? Anyway, all right. Let's see. So that was one that connected to stuff we talked about before. What else might
look at all those tabs?
Yeah, I think maybe I'll talk about this because I always do whenever I see one. It is
it's
Digicomp
red.
One. It's kind of a weird picture of it.
Oh, these. Yeah. Sure.
So this second photo shows it a little better. It is a computer made of plastic by ESR.
Well, so is the thing in front of me.
Yeah. But this is it's only like little plastic things, metal rods and rubber bands, and it can do...
Again, my Mac Studio. Good description. Yeah.
It's cool though. I think it's 1964 or something like that. And you know, it's basically just it's programmable by you know, sort of. I don't even know how it works. I mean, you know, you put little pegs in various places, and it changes how the clock, you know, shifts things around, and it can count to 7 in various ways that you program.
And for a certain person, a certain type of programmer, like the lack of go-to, really appealing on these.
Yeah, you're the best programmer if you use
one of these.
But so anyway, I think it's kind of a neat thing, and this one seems to be, you know, you can buy it for $90, which is maybe a little much, but it's probably less than they often go for, and the starting bid is $25. It looks fairly complete.
They keep coming up, though, over the years we've talked about these. You think everybody who wants one would have one by now? Like, what's the market for these things?
I don't know. But there aren't a lot of them out there.
Is it you, Paul?
I have one yet.
Oh, that's very few. That's not a full poll.
But the thing is, I basically inherited it. That, like, it was in my grandmother's house.
Oh, really? So, like, an actual... vintage one, not one that you bought from somewhere.
Yep.
So kind of neat.
Cool.
Though I did get recently this I had this show up.
The Dr. Nim. We've talked about those too.
Why is there no picture of it? But
I guess why would they show a picture of the old Dr. Nim? There you go.
Yeah, the amazing Dr. Nim board game, which is it's basically a come on. There must be a picture.
That's the one
here.
With the little, the little white T-shaped things that rotate and like the marble falls down through the tracks. Yeah, I remember this thing.
And apparently if you play it by the rules, it is in fact unbeatable. Like it will always win, but there are certain variants on the rules that you can use to like make a mistake occasionally. but it is also funny that it can just work, you know, it can do this by just having a couple of little flip-flops that get pushed around by a marble. So there were three things in the ESR stable of games, Dr. Nim and or sort of mini computers. There was Dr. Nim, and there was what was the name of that other one? Because I also have one of these. I'll find it at some point, but I'll think about.
Oh, the thing about right.
Yeah. So, I now have the full set of ESR 1965 games.
Nice. I see online there's a lot of things discussing the Dr. Nim and a YouTube video about Dr. Nim, but most of them hold up the box without the very problematic Asian character in the bottom left corner, which is
It was the 1960s. It's true,
and that box art has not aged well.
No.
The Thinkadot I have not seen. That's an interesting one. It looks like it has a series of rotors on a on a vertical plane, and the marbles fall through it to simulate flip-flops or whatever.
Yeah.
Oh, it's got a cover over it normally. Oh, I see. So that image we were looking at was the internals. Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, so it's a little bit more obscure what's actually happening.
Okay. That would be kind of fun, I would imagine, as a kid, like not necessarily knowing how it's doing what it's doing inside. That's kind of neat.
Yeah. So you drop a marble into one of these top three spots, and it has some effect on the dots that are showing.
Yeah.
And then the marble comes out one side or the other, and then you can do it again.
Can computers really be fun?
So this, I guess I posted a picture of this in their internal Discord, but it says Thinkadot is a computer game and is fun.
I love all the judginess of this marketing copy. Like, computers are stupid, right? Don't you hate them? They're so dumb and boring, right? No, we like them already. You don't have to sell that.
Yeah.
Computers can't possibly be fun.
Another thing I found is fairly complete Aquarius set. So this is I think this is the same one I have. And most of the time when I see these, they are not this complete. So, and in fact, I think I have this one because like 10 years ago, I outbid Earl.
Oh, wow. That's why it's not on the show today. He's still
That's why you guys don't get along.
Yeah. He knew you were going to bring this listing up. Hey, Earl, look what I got.
But so this one's nice. It's starting at $20. It is.
It'd be more fun if you've continued. You've got like nine of these now, and you continually outbid Earl. It'd be great on this one. You're saying, "Hey, Earl, this one's only $19. You got a chance." You're like Lucy with the football. I won't bid this time. I won't snipe. It's all good. This one's yours, Earl. And then nope.
Just building a fort out of Aquarius's. Every recording, there's just more Aquarii behind him.
Yeah, it's sort of like Carrington with his like additional chairs appearing.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. I was shopping the other day, and I was out with a pal. We were at Farm Boy, and yes, my pal stood there and said, "Is anybody noticing your bag? You're making friends." I'm like, "Stop mocking me! This bag will work one day."
Your Beagle Brothers bag.
My big old brother's bag, which has yet to make me friends, but has made my friends make fun of me quite a bit.
Well, it's very discerning. That's all. When you someday, when you do make a friend, you're going to be best friends instantly. Because
exactly right. That's what I keep saying. Someone will notice, and the fact that they notice means we will be pals.
I had someone notice the Beagle Brothers sticker on my laptop the other day, and they asked. They asked if that was the company that I work for.
Oh,
so that was.
You can't be friends with that person.
It's like, oh gosh, how do I explain this? It's like, well, I like really old computers, and there was this company, and there was these guys, and they were funny, and now I have their sticker. It's just, it was a lot to try and explain. So I didn't.
Just glowered and walked
just
away.
How could you not? Yeah.
So much work to explain myself.
But I didn't know that the Aquarius had these weird disc controllers that look like Intellivision controllers.
Yeah, they do look like Intellivision controllers.
But
it was by Mattel, so I guess Mattel just loved their...
I suppose, they had they had Aquarius technology on hand when they made the Intellivision, apparently. They probably had a warehouse full of those stupid discs that they had to use up. Maybe that's why the Intellivision got that controller.
Wasn't there... I think maybe a time or two ago that we had found... Someone had found like a joystick that you can put on Intellivision disc.
Yeah, there were such products. Yeah, I will say I am a defender of the Intellivision disc. I really liked it because it allowed you to swing your thumb around without lifting, which was very good in games like Utopia or driving games, things like that. So I am a defender of the disc, but not well liked. However,
nope.
Yeah, so in this box basically contains like all of the, a large number of the Aquarius parts you might want if you wanted to just start. So it has, the box itself is kind of beat up, but it has within it, oh, and it weighs something exact. But so it has a 4K memory expansion, little cartridge. It has the Night Stalker game. And one thing about the...
Oh, their cartridges are weird.
Yeah, yeah. They're sort of wedge-shaped.
I never realized.
Yeah. Let's see if I can...
Night Stalker was a good game for the...
Yeah, for the Intellivision. Yeah, one of the best. Mm. That was super good.
Yeah. I guess
it's got the little overlays, too, for the six buttons on the... Mm-hmm. This thing is very Intellivision-like. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, I was going to say the we were talking about overlays and so for yeah. I guess the PC Junior and you know each game had its own overlay. I think that yeah. also maybe even for the keyboard.
Yeah, because that was Intellivision's famously sort of killer feature was that they had the cool overlays for every game. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know that. It looks like they paved a bunch of that ground with the Aquarius beforehand.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Huh. It's funny when I think about the Intellivision overlays. I can feel that
crinkly plastic. Of, yeah.
It's just, oh my gosh! Yeah. It's just embedded in me. I'm like, yep.
And all the important ones were always worn away, so you couldn't read the artwork anymore. Yeah. It'd be just a clear hole in the plastic right there yeah. on the fire button.
Or if you lost it, like, okay, I think I pressed this to bid in blackjack. Yeah. What do I like that?
Yeah, I had. So I got a you know it's sort of like a multi-cart kind of thing for the Aquarius that just has like all of the things they ever produced. But one of the things you don't get with that is the overlay for all of them. So it's kind of like Vectrex, the same deal with the Vectrex. I'm gesturing at the Vectrex, but you can have a single ROM that has all the games on it, but the Vectrex has a color overlay that sometimes shows you the boundaries of the places you can go. Right.
Yeah.
So all the manuals, you know, the mini expander, which lets you plug in two cartridges at once, so you can have RAM and your game. And the controllers.
This is a lot of stuff. It's like all of the Aquarius stuff.
Yep. There was a printer and I think I have a modem and a cassette drive that are not in here. But
an Aquarius modem. Wow.
Almost everything else.
Yeah. What would you do with an Aquarius modem?
What wouldn't you do? But yeah.
There's some 300 so BPS there. Aquarius BBS out there.
Perhaps, yeah. Mm. I have not. I think it's probably still. You know, like I don't think it's come out of the box since I got it. But it would be interesting to.
It wasn't about having it; it was about denying yeah, Earl to right. have it. I understand.
This it's particular auction. Move. It also includes the receipt, which I think is kind of a neat feature. You can you can see.
Cool. Oh wow! Look at that.
Yeah.
So this person actually bought all of this stuff.
Hmm.
The Metal Electronics Repair Center.
Oh, Hawthorne, California.
Yep.
I used to live right near there, actually. I used to live in Torrance, which is just down the road from Hawthorne.
Ah, okay.
Hawthorne.
Be hilarious if we knew from this that the original owner of this was Earl Evans. You're like, I'm going to buy this one, too. And I'm going to send it to him. Because I not only denied you, but I took your first one.
Right. Apparently they are. I mean, like, you know, so... They are quite limited as machines. You know, they don't have much memory.
Yeah, that's what I've heard as well, that it kind of sucks.
But there's something sort of appealing about it anyway. So,
there's no PC Junior, but...
Let's see. Man, okay.
No love for the PC Junior.
So, this one I thought was sort of interesting just from the name. This is a Ordinathan. Electronic encyclopedia game. It's in French, and so that made me wonder, you know, because I don't really know much about like the French computing scene. Is ordi as a prefix kind of like micro is in English? I mean, like, are there a lot of ordi things in French?
There are not, but the word for computer, of course, is ordinateur, so that would be where they're getting that from. But it wasn't like a common prefix like micro, I don't think. Now,
yeah, I don't know.
But Ordinathan would be just be like a kind of a pun.
Were you waiting for the Canadians to come on for you to ask that? Is that what you?
I don't. You know, again, I don't know if it's at all fun. You know, but it's an encyclopedia game. It says.
that's.
Oh, then no. The answer is no. It's not fun.
Like the encyclopedia.
No, Thinkabot.
So there you can find on YouTube at least a couple of people talking about. Let's see if I can make them not talk in my ear though. Sort of demonstrating what it does, and
it looks like a big calculator. Oh, it has overlays. That's why it's so big. Okay.
So you tell it what overlay you put on it, and then you answer the questions it asks, or something.
It's one of those educational things where it just responds with codes, and then you look up the code in the book to see what you're supposed to push next or whatever. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So probably I think we can conclude from this, not really fun.
Yeah. No actual fun. Yeah. Actual fun may vary.
Right.
Actual fun will not vary. It'll be none. It will stay none.
Fun purchased separately.
Mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, one thing I have not responded or mentioned the notes in the chat, but 01 Craft says they actually reached Wizardry 5 on the Apple II. That the Intellivision disc was the precursor to the D-pad, and the actual Aquarius hardware is horrible. It's like Intellivision where they left off.
Essentially an Intellivision, with the left off the graphics.
Yeah.
So I guess it's sort of like the Coleco Atom in that sense, which is basically a stripped down ColecoVision with a bunch of computer trappings added around the periphery of it. Pardon the pun.
At the start of that, it sounded like you said Nutellivision. I was like, oh, that would have been interesting.
Yes. Not fast, sticky, but delicious.
That's right. But also very bad if it overheats.
Yeah. Right. What a mess. All over your floppy disks. Yeah.
Here's a Apple branded candy jar.
Yeah, that looks a lot like stickers on a candy jar to me.
It is.
I think that's stickers on a jar.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure my collector's eye sussed out. That's just stickers on a jar.
We always have something like this, because the stickers are just everywhere. They gave them out with everything you bought. So people put Apple stickers on everything, and now 50 years later, everybody thinks all this stuff is Apple branded.
More collectible to find.
Like, no, people just put those
1985 jars that don't have stickers.
I want to see like used car ads 10 years from now where it's like Apple branded Toyota Acura.
Okay, let's see. This one, I think. So Amnesia, I've just found a listing for this. It's an Electronic Arts game for the Apple II. I think probably may have existed for other platforms as well. It's one of these Electronic Arts games that came in like an album folder. Those are always pretty cool.
Folio, I believe, is what they called that.
A folio, yeah.
Ooh.
And so it has, it has a little code wheel and a couple of manuals. The one of these manuals is a map. I don't know if they've folded it out, but it's like a subway map of the city. Yeah, there you can see it, the Manhattan street map. And so it's basically it is a novel that you kind of play. And so I don't know this author, Thomas Dish, but I think this is a well-known author. Is this an author known to either of you as like a sci-fi writer?
Not to me.
Okay.
No.
Fair enough. But nevertheless, this is somebody that I don't know whose idea it was, but the idea is essentially, writing a for real novelist writing this adventure game. Whatever, it ties in a little bit with the book, that we were talking about earlier, right? The book game. So I thought that was possibly relevant. And also it allows me to mention John Aycock's book, Amnesia Remembered, which is also pretty interesting and not on eBay, but still possibly worth taking a look at.
Yep. Kay and I was just talking about that on Imaguru, and it's very cool, like a deep dive into the guts of this game. Expensive because it's the I think
academic
book,
what do you call it? Like this,
academic book. That's what the thinking book. As all my degrees just
really
fall away.
It says the man book with actual degrees in English. Yep. The thinking book.
I got my degrees mostly from street learning.
Clearly.
Learn with an apostrophe. I find academic humor or writing humorous. Maybe it's because I don't understand any of it. Anyway, this looks awesome. You can get an ebook version as well, which isn't crazy money. Oh, it shows on screen.
$35,
I can read. Yeah. $150 bucks for the hardback. Yeah. But $35. This looks really, really cool. Like super, super cool to me. I'm almost certainly going to pull the trigger on the ebook. I got to read this.
Yeah, so this is it's an entry in it's considered digital archaeology, but what's so it's specifically about that game, the Amnesia game, and kind of like looking at it in terms of an artifact. Like, so the premise of this book is basically he's writing to archaeologists saying this stuff is also, you can apply your archaeology to this validly, so he's also trying to make the case that this is a valid deployment of archaeological techniques, and he's writing it to convince archaeologists. So it is all kind of, in those terms, so that's also interesting and a kind of an approach that I am unfamiliar with, but it's a neat idea.
I see. So he's trying to make the case that like studying compression, copy protection, memory management, et cetera, is like that is worthy of study in old software. Is that the idea?
Yeah.
Okay. That's cool. That's cool. So, I like that.
As a go-to reference to
University
learn how to...
Calgary.
Yeah. Ah, nice.
Oh, I've met him. Yeah. Okay. Weird. Okay. Yeah. The name sounded familiar, but I couldn't place it until I saw U of C. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Hi, John. If you're listening, we've met.
Yeah. So Amnesia is shown to be a multi-layered artifact with a complex backstory. Through it, topics in data compression, copy protection, memory management, and programming languages are covered. So it's also kind of a neat center point to talk about, all kinds of other stuff with relation to as well. So
neat thing about Amnesia is the game came out in whatever, 1980-something, but this author had written it as a book. Like, it was a full novel. It was supposed to come out by HarperCollins or something. And then it didn't get released. So it got picked up by Electronic Arts, who made the game. And it was only in, 2008 or 2009, somebody came across a bunch of, old files about the game and the manufacturer and discovered in it the complete manuscript of the book that never got published. So suddenly there was also available the whole book. I'm going to stick in the show notes in case anybody's interested. I found a link to the PDF of the manuscript hosted by Jason Scott of the whole original novel. So I'll stick that in.
Interesting. It seems to me, now what was I was trying to remember what this related to. There was something that I read. It might be the TV show Dark Matter. Where the way that was made, so I don't know if this is a total tangent perhaps, but the sci-fi show Dark Matter, it was good. I wish it was
show.
Still made. But I think the way it was made was actually that in order to generate interest from the studios, they made a graphic novel first. The goal was always to make a series, but they wanted to make a graphic novel so they could say, we want to make a series out of this graphic novel. And
I've heard that being done, because everything in Hollywood now has to be based on some existing IP. So if in doubt, create the IP so that you can base your thing on it that you want to make.
Yeah.
I have heard of that.
Okay, let's see. What else is relevant here? Probably. Oh,
that is a nice looking 2GS keyboard.
I like the 2GS keyboard. Was fan from the beginning, and I was like, look at that intelligent place to put a caps lock.
It is my favorite keyboard, absolutely, of all of them ever.
Great feel, just everything about this keyboard is wonderful.
Yeah, and it's also sort of like the most compact of the ADB keyboards.
It's a perfect size. There's no wasted space on it, which I love. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. Arrow keys, not a fan of the all in a row, but other than that,
I love it. The one big weakness is the ADB connectors on it are terrible. You have to be very careful how you plug and unplug it, or you will wreck them.
And I think it's because the way they were tucked in like that, they got yanked around a lot.
Yeah, ADB connectors are really tight, and the mechanical mounting of them in this keyboard is not sufficient for the amount of force that an ADB cable requires. It's there's a lot of friction, and when you're pushing in the cable, you can feel the connector flexing on the circuit board in there, and it's not a good feeling when you plug it in. Yeah.
I see. So you want to plug it in and leave it. Yeah.
Loved it from the first day.
Oh, yeah.
First time I I was like, this keyboard's amazing.
Best keyboard Apple ever made, in my opinion.
You found one, right? Like, you were looking for one and eventually found
one? I did. Yeah, they are weirdly expensive now, these keyboards. Prices on them have gone through the roof, and I could not get one for anything close to what I was willing to pay, but a K-Fester hooked me up, so I won't name him in case he doesn't want to be embarrassed here, but you know who you are. Thank you very much. So, he sent me a keyboard and a mouse for my GS, because, I recovered my GS from my parents' basement, but the keyboard and mouse are gone, and which made me very sad. Yeah, I think what happened was, because I like the keyboard and mouse so much from the GS, I think I took it with me into my Mac life that then went with me to the States, and somewhere in the US I must have gotten rid of them.
I did as well. I used that keyboard on the first few Macs I owned. That keyboard just kept coming with me. I'm like, whatever, new keyboard. I like this one. I loved it so much.
Yeah, but I was very sad to lose it. So I have one now, which is great, but there's something about your keyboard, your original. I was sad that it's not mine, mine, but...
The only thing better than using your keyboard is taking Earl's.
That is better, yeah. I like to imagine that everything I own was Earl's at some point.
Earl picked the wrong show to skip.
So I don't know what the prices were that you were seeing, but... $110.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem too bad, but it's...
That's actually pretty good for GS keyboards right now. Yeah, when I was looking, at least like Canadian, I couldn't find anyone less than about 200 plus, you know, people want like $100 to ship them. Like, it's bonkers what these keyboards are going for. I think because people think they're old Mac keyboards, it's probably why people don't like, if people knew they were two GS keyboards, they'd be worthless because nobody even knows what that is. But because people think they're Mac keyboards and they do work on Macs, retro Mac stuff is a lot more valuable than a GS stuff would be.
And I mean, honestly, the space thing is the thing for me. I mean, like, Apple keyboard two, you know, whatever that is, extended keyboard two or whatever they call it. I mean, like, it's, people like it, but I mean, the thing, you know, you need an entire desk for it.
That's it.
And the shape of this is the same as the Apple keyboard two, not the extended one. Like, Apple makes another keyboard that from a distance looks like
a little bigger.
But it's a little bigger, and the
key stuff, it doesn't feel the same. You can tell from the caps lock. Look at where the caps lock is.
And the reset button at the top on the bad one, it's like rounded and lower profile. On the GS one, it's like a big brick sticking up out of the bezel. You can see their giveaway. But yeah, those early Mac ADB keyboards were all huge. Like, they were all giant things, and this one was so compact and nice.
One thing about this one. I have a funny thing, which is it's like a plastic overlay for that particular keyboard.
Keyboard condom.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So it fits exactly. It has the little, you know, the space for the reset.
Does it affect the feel of the keyboard though? Because like part of the joy of the keyboard
you're typing
all of those things make the keyboard terrible.
Yeah. But you're typing. I mean, the keys move the right way, but otherwise it's like you're taking orders at McDonald's.
Yeah. Those were only used when your computer was in an auto shop or something where, like, extreme filth was unavoidable, because otherwise they were all terrible.
That's just regular filth.
Extreme
filth. It's like from the 90s. Extreme filth.
But it's still, I mean, I'm still somewhat amazed that, you know, somehow that thing for that specific keyboard managed to make its way to, like, my shelf here. I mean, like, because I mean, the keyboard itself was not that common, and you know, someone had to make the thing for it, and then someone had to not throw it away. it's always kind of amazing when things like that survive.
Like we talked about that shrink wrapped wizardry expansion. Mm-hmm. I'm amazed something like that survives this many decades, still in shrink wrap. Someone never opened that thing in all this time.
Yeah,
that's I find that amazing.
Thanks for the game, Mom. I have no interest. I'll never open it. I hate you. Imagine the Christmas morning that game was part of. I want it, Ultima.
I'll only mention one more thing, and then I'll... Quinn, did you have any that you wanted to...
Nope.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, no, like I said at the top, we were supposed to have a lot of hosts today, so I went light on content thinking there was going to be six of us.
Yeah.
Yep. There's at least three of me. Well,
yeah, and Carrington counts, for like three people. So.
I do. I can't read, but I count.
You got that thinking number head thing.
Yeah. Yeah, anyway, and this, you know, I don't know what I think about this one, but it's, I thought it was interesting because I hadn't heard of it before. It's the Canon X07, which looks like a, scientific calculator or whatever, but it is actually a little computer with a Z80 in it, Z80.
So this was going after like the Model 100 sort of market? How big is this thing?
I don't know. Like physically, well, let's see. Physically, it is, I don't know, all the pictures show it uncontextualized. Yeah. But, you know, I think it's much smaller than a Model 100.
Okay.
But it runs Microsoft Basic, so it is a little computer. It has a place for memory expansion.
So it's more like those little Tandy pocket computers that Radio Shack used to sell that were kind of like the size of like 5 credit cards, and they ran a little Basic in them.
Yeah. Apparently it was actually quite popular in like France, and you know, in Europe. It was a big deal for, it was like 1983 or something. It actually had pretty good graphics, surprisingly. So if you had plugged it into the video expander, it could do like color graphics in a fairly impressive way.
Really?
And I had never heard about this before.
That's surprising.
So I kind of wanted one, but this one went for almost $200. It's already sold. So
I see there was a matching sized color plotter,
mm-hmm.
same width, you could put it in front and it would be your little print, one of those little plotters.
It has a few sort of accessories that you can get, a plotter, a printer, the video interface. So
it'll run
hopefully,
you.
Yeah. Let's see if they have any information on the video. So, I mean,
oh yeah, you can Canon video interface. Look at that. It's got like 4 or 5 colors and looks like not terrible resolution. Like it's maybe like 160x80 or something.
Yeah.
Maybe even better.
250. Okay. So it says 256x192 with 6 colors.
Wow.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. That's shockingly good.
Yeah.
Okay.
6 colors. That's better than the Apple II.
Yeah. Well, the Apple II had like 2 blacks and 2 whites, you know, so.
Yeah.
Damn, none of those.
It looks like it would be pretty fun to play with these, and I would have thought they were sort of plentiful, but in Europe, you know, and probably also Japan.
The keyboard on it is distinctive. It has those beveled keys that I've only ever seen on HP calculators. Mm-hmm. So that's really interesting, where the shift character on each key is on an angle so that it's sort of easier to see, I guess, from above.
Hmm.
But I've only ever seen that on HP calculators. That was kind of like their signature design thing, was those beveled keys. So it's interesting to see them somewhere else.
Yeah. Anyway, so if I come across one of these, I think I would be interested in it, but,
Every show now, we just have another retro computer that I've never heard of.
Yeah.
Like, there's just always more of them, which is amazing.
Oh, well, I mean, speaking of that, there was one other one that this reminded me of. Oh, here's a mouse nest. You can get 80 MO100s.
Wow. That's a lot of MO100 mice.
Yeah. And in fact, there are 2 left, 2 of these 80 blocks of mice left.
Two of those boxes.
2 of the boxes. If you want a box of 80
mice.
Oh, wow,
okay. Jeez, for $3,000.
I would hope so. But 3 of them have sold at that price?
I don't know for sure if it was at that price, but three of the five.
3 flats of 80 mice have sold. To who?
I don't know. Charles Mangan?
Yeah, Charles Mangan, yeah. Someone's probably going to flip them individually, and they made an offer that they figure they can get back. That'd be my guess.
But that's almost $40 a mouse.
Yeah, but I bet you could probably get 60 or 80 a mouse, because those MO100 mice, they go for something.
And they may, it's possible that they may have made a deal for them. But so this seller, if you know Sun Remarketing, they're the ones that had all the leases that eventually got confiscated and buried.
Yeah, they've been around forever.
But this is like surplus stock from that. So this is the Sun.
This is Sun Remarketing.
Yeah, the Sun of Sun Remarketing. So it's interesting stuff, and I think there's just a lot of it. But that wasn't the thing I was going to talk about. I wanted to mention another computer I'd never heard of. Maybe you had the Mindset.
No, what is that?
It's the Mindset computer.
What? What is?
I've never heard of this.
What is this thing? Are those 3.5-inch drives? Wow, look at that mouse. That's so weird looking.
I think they're 5.25-inch.
This looks like a prototype, like an actual computer. So it's like, but we're planning to make a computer like this.
But no, it was an actual computer. And
what interesting industrial design! Holy moly. Which makes for great radio, I'm sure everybody listening.
Yeah, we're just like looking at,
wow, interesting. So
on this episode of RCR Reacts to Things.
Yeah. But so it's a 80186 computer, MS-DOS computer.
Oh, those are rare. Not a lot of machines actually use that chip.
186.
Yeah. Everyone just skipped right over that one.
Just blew past that thing. I said, hey, where's everyone going? 286, you say? Oh, man.
So I think it came out just before Windows 1, and it had a dedicated graphics chip, which the other ones, which a lot of prior computers didn't have, so it was ahead of the game in the graphics department, because it had a design that would allow for, better graphics, faster access.
Oh, hardware blitter. Wow.
Yeah.
That's weird in a PC.
Right.
And I think somewhere it says here that the sort of industrial design of it was done by somebody who then later on went to do Apple's. So probably this is...
You can kind of see how somebody who made this would go on and have...
Yeah, here we go.
Like 4 years later, they're involved in the Snow White design language or whatever.
1989 to 1987.
It also said that some of the engineers were original Amiga and Atari engineers, mm-hmm. which explains the dedicated graphics chip. Interesting.
It's just, the case for the Mindset is included by the Museum of Modern Art in New York in its permanent collection, probably somewhere near the G4 Cube.
Do we know what the things below the floppy drives are? It looks like something that pulls out, like little cartridges or something.
Yeah, I think they were like ROM packs of some kind.
Memory expansions or something.
Yeah. But essentially, this was – so I think the general opinion of this was that it was actually a really good computer. So this was a little bit like the what you were saying about the PC Junior,
Yeah.
And it somehow missed its niche. So it lasted like a year and then just faded. And like I hadn't heard about it until I came across it like a week ago.
It was expensive. Wow. $1,800 in 1984. Equivalent to $5,100 today. That's a lot of money for a PC.
Mm. So that may have had something to do with it.
Yeah.
I think the reason I came across this in the first place is that someone was selling a Mindset mouse by itself, and I didn't know what a Mindset even was. So I looked, and this actual auction is over, and it sold for $1,530. So like $1,530. So it is a collector's object. But anyway. So you hadn't heard of it either. I'm not alone.
Never.
No, I wonder if it actually ran like PC software or if it was all custom.
I think it ran... Well, I think it would run MS-DOS. Some DOS.
Like it was XT compatible or something?
Yeah.
Because with that custom graphics chip, like you'd have to write custom software to support that.
Yeah, okay. So the ROM does not run about 20% of the PC software base, including Microsoft Flight Simulator.
Okay.
So probably the best thing they would have wanted to have to test with didn't
work.
Yeah, but still, that's tough though. You say we're mostly compatible.
Yeah, like I'm going to pay more for something that's only 80% compatible. Yeah. That doesn't make any sense. Yeah, you can kind of see why this.
Yeah, this WordStar reportedly runs, but like you're looking to buy it, like that would have really hurt sales.
Curtis in the chat says that the Tandy 2000 is one of the few. That Curtis knows of used the 186. Tim recommends a few videos on this, I guess, about the Mindset from the Tech Time Traveler channel. So,
okay.
So maybe that's enough. the computers we've never heard of.
Cool. There are many.
So I guess we can go.
Ooh, sorry to interrupt you. Maybe I was a little too hard on it price-wise, because I just looked up The original list price of the original PC XT was $1,565. So this is in that ballpark, which with a hard drive was $7,500.
Right. And the Mac, original Mac, was like $2,500.
Yeah. So,
I mean, it was famously expensive.
Yeah. But. So that maybe it was a little more expensive than XTs at the time in 19... What, that thing came out in 84?
84.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe, yeah, maybe a little more expensive than a clone at the time, but not crazy expensive. Okay.
Yeah, we forget like how expensive computers were.
Yeah.
Like it's unbelievable how cheap computers just have gotten.
Yeah, our Apple II Plus was $3,500. I'll always remember that, which was crazy money, like for something like that at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, Canadian.
Yeah.
So what is?
Yeah. Well,
was
crazy
that,
money.
$1.50 US. Change. I don't know. Whatever. Yeah. It's not real money.
Like a fiver. Yeah.
A couple of quid.
Okay. So we can, I guess, now move to closing discussions. And I guess, Carrington, this is you first, alphabetically.
Don't know that I got much. Podcasting again, which is cool. Playing a lot of games. It's fun. Not really good at them. Just typical.
What are you playing?
Stuff for Eat My Grew. So right now we're doing Adventureland, first Scott Adams game.
Oh, wow.
Oh, boy, after playing a lot of nice adventure games and Infocom things, you hit that interface and it is just hard.
Those two words.
It is a slog. Yeah, those two-word parser. That's not too bad, but just the look of the game. 40 columns. You got to look at the top of the screen to see the results of what you're typing, and there's no spaces anywhere. It's a slog at the moment.
Those games are rough.
Plus, I think the version I have has a bug in it, but I don't know for sure. Is it just like, does this have a bug, or do I not have the object I need? And there's like no way to know without looking through a walkthrough. I don't want to look at a walkthrough, so I don't know. I'm just walking around trying to find another set of keys. So the one I have doesn't apparently work.
So. Yeah, there was not a lot of QA on those games. They are notoriously buggy.
Right.
And notoriously... Yeah. Unfairly difficult, like just puzzles that are
I just die
unsolvable
all the time.
And
I'm just dying.
Yeah.
Rub the lamp, it's good. Rub it again, great. Rub a third time, dead. Oh, come on. Oh, actually, I don't die. I just took away stuff of mine. I'm like, restart again.
All right, let's see. For me, I don't know. You know, lots of stuff have been happening. I guess in the retro adjacent world, I have a bunch of stuff in my office. This has sort of come up, I guess, at various times. And it actually was sort of spread across two rooms. I had two office spaces. And I used the word was because I sort of lost access to, I have to clear out one of those two spaces, which means it all has to go into a single of those spaces.
Oh.
And so that's been an interesting challenge to try to Tetris everything together. And but it's been kind of fun seeing this stuff again, you know, like, oh, I have this. Oh, why do I have so many of these? I need to have fewer of these.
Do you have like six Aquariuses that you're just going to set on fire on camera in front of a roll
just
to get rid of them? Got so many of these. I just got to get rid of them.
Yeah.
I don't know what to do.
But it's, I mean, it is fun to see this stuff again. It's also kind of motivation to get down to fewer things. So I'm kind of hoping, I mean, like the project I always wanted to, Carrington is gesturing to his background. The project I always kind of wanted to do was sort of like take out individual things and, you know, take videos of interacting with them and, you know, scan them and photograph them and then move them on to someone who actually wants to use them.
So that kind of thing would be useful because a lot of people get things, they scan them, they stick them on Internet Archive, and that's very useful, having documents of things. But it's also useful to have a video of, like, here's me interacting with it, what it sounds like, what it feels like, weight, like actually interacting with the thing physically.
Yeah. And if you're looking at a scanned manual,
that's a lot of work, though.
Like, you can't see on the scan that the thing is actually only like 6 inches tall or a giant book or whatever. I mean, like you lose some of that. I may start doing that. We'll see. But
cool.
So that's what I'm doing. How about you, Gwen? Any closing notes?
I've been busy retro wise. So I've kind of made a push on my 2GS game that I've been working on for Chex Notes 7 years, which, you know, 7 years in the making sounds like it's going to be great, but it won't be. It's just I realized that I've really only been working on it on airplanes, and I don't travel nearly as much as I used to, and so I basically have made zero progress on it for years, and that was bothering me. So I kind of dug into it again, and I've now got it to, I would say I'm 50 or 60 hours away from like a first playable something that I could actually cool. like show to people. So that's kind of my current goal, is to just get it up to where I feel like people could play it, and I just tell me if it's fun, or, you know, make some suggestions, that kind of thing. I don't think it'll ever be super fun, but if I could at least get it playable and call it a finished game is kind of my goal. So that's been happening. I've been working on that. And been plugging away at some of my other retro stuff. I don't remember if I told you I got the Commodore 64 keyboard fixed. That was quite an adventure. Yeah, I think on the Lane Nooney episode I talked about that. I had to take the keyboard apart and clean every single key switch and all this other stuff. It still has the issue where it's unstable. After running for 10 or 20 minutes, it'll just crash. And so I suspect maybe it's got a bad RAM or something. I don't think all of the Commodore software is this buggy. So it just seems to lock up a lot. But it does work now. And I just got my my 2GS keyboard and mouse in. So I'm going to get those up and running so I can test my game on real hardware. My GS has not, I have yet to boot my GS since I shut it down in the 90s and put it in my parents' basement. So,
and isn't it the case that the GS emulators aren't like super accurate or something?
Yeah, the emulation scene is not great. It's been getting better, I will say. You know, some folks like Kent Dickey has been maintaining kegs in quiet thanklessness. He's been quietly fixing bugs and stuff in that. And GS Plus has had a little bit of maintenance from Dagan Brock. He's kept it up with macOS. But like some of the older classic ones, like Sweet 16, have been murdered by macOS updates and various apocalypse the 32-bit one and various SSL things and stuff that keep murdering old software on the Mac. So that's but anyway, it's been getting better, the emulation stuff. Anyway, long story short, so I can get my 2GS hardware up and running again and test on real hardware, which will be nice. I have my old 2GS hard drive. I had a 40 megabyte hard drive in an enclosure, SCSI hard drive that I built an enclosure for, and I booted straight into GNO, whatever you call it, the Unix-like environment for the 2GS. And at some point towards the end of my use of that machine, I deleted some file to make space on the hard drive. I was really desperate for space, and I started just like an idiot, started just going in and deleting files that didn't look important. I really did do that. And I deleted some file that now GNO no longer boots. And so I don't know how I'm going to fix that, to be honest. But I think I could still probably boot GSOS from floppies and then get access to the hard drive that way. I don't know. We'll see. But my memory is the last time I left the machine, it no longer booted the hard drive. But in theory, there's old programming projects and who knows what else on that hard drive. So it would be fun to get it up and running and poke around on it. Lots of stuff going on for me retro wise. It's been a good several months since we talked.
Yeah. Last. Cool. That's, I hope that's not the only thing that made them good, but
yeah, no, it's nice to have something to talk about in this segment. Yeah. Cause for the last like 5 years, I've just been like, nope, don't do nothing anymore. Yeah. So it's fun to actually have stuff to talk about. Yeah. And if anyone wants to see the current progress on my game, I mean, it's all there on GitHub. I've been pushing to that repo, so you can always just pull that and run it if you really want to see it. But it's there will be
if it works at ground level.
Yeah, there will be an official release of it at some point once I feel like it's reasonably stable and I got to test it. I've only ever tested it on one emulator, so I want to test it on real hardware and stuff like that as well before I kind of make it officially available.
Cool. Yeah, that reminds me of that. I have a kind of. I don't know what, 60% finished game that I just stopped working on altogether for the and I should someday get back to that, but first I need to deal with my office. So
the thing I'll say, the thing that motivates me to finish projects like this is there's other things I want to do. Like I have other ideas for retro games. I've got an 8-bit Apple II thing I want to do and another GS thing I want to do. And I don't let myself start the new thing until I finish the current thing. Yeah. So frequently...
Because you'd never go back and finish the current
thing. Exactly. Because that was my teenage years was just unfinished the dozens and dozens of 40 to 60% finished things. And I hate that. Now as an adult, I don't let myself start a new thing until I finish the old one, which is, I find, very motivating because the excitement of the new thing will push me through to finish the current thing.
Maybe this is an argument for not resurrecting your hard drive, though, if what it leads you to is like three dozen old things not finished.
I mean, my experience with my 8-bit stuff was that none of that stuff is as fun or neat as I remember. I thought I had all kinds of cool programming projects on those floppies, and mostly it was just a bunch of teenage garbage. And yeah, it was nothing worth salvaging. So the GS is probably similar. Okay. I don't recall writing anything especially good. I was never an assembly programmer back in the day on the GS. It's part of the reason I'm doing this current game was because I wanted to learn proper 2GS game programming. But so it was all in C. I wrote a lot of stuff in Orca C, but C is just too slow to do very much on the GS. So nothing was ever very good because it was all written in C. And I have a lot of memories of compiling Orca C on my GS. And I mean, a compile was a good 20 minutes to an hour for a compile, and just sitting there
just to find the latest bugs,
just to find out how many new bugs you have. Yeah, it was not fast. So I don't know why I put up with that, but I did.
I guess that we have made it through. And so that's it for the show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can find lo-fi episodes and more via the Gopher, also at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org. You can follow RCR on Mastodon. We are podcasts.social at rcrpodcast. How do you say those things? We are maybe rcrpodcast at podcasts.social.
I don't toot.
Something like that. We also have a Facebook group. It is facebook.com/groups/RCR podcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.net. And please write a review on iTunes, even if the feed doesn't work. until next time,
Retro Compute!